Today we'll be looking at the question whether special relativity should be regarded as a possible template for a fundamental reformulation of quantum mechanics. I'll just mention that much of what I say in this talk is based on a paper that Christopher Timpson and I wrote relatively recently. Incident, just before I start, there's going to be a meeting of the members of the Institute at 1 o'clock in this room. No doubt you're aware of this meeting. I think it's only fair for me to give people a chance to get some lunch. So what I propose to do is to speak for roughly an hour, a bit less perhaps, and then without a break, we'll go straight into discussion, and we'll stop around 10 past 12, so people have a chance to get lunch before the 1 o'clock meeting. And the same thing will happen next week, by the way. No doubt that will be a relief to many of you. Well, last time we looked at the nature of Einstein's 1905 argument and the Ignatovsky variation on the same theme. Again, this is an argument based on symmetry principles, essentially, and Einstein's famous postulates, the relativity principle and the light postulate. In fact, there are two separate applications of the relativity principle. The first is to use with the light postulate to infer the invariance of the speed of light. And the second, along with spatial isotropy, another symmetry principle, the scale factor involved in the so-called K Lorentz transformations, that's to say the Lorentz transformations multiplied by an arbitrary scale factor, those transformations, of course, being consistent with the invariance of the speed of light, that scale factor is equal to 1, and this is something that had bedeviled all the earlier approaches to the Lorentz transformations based on ether theories, as I mentioned last time. And of course, Ignatovsky just put aside the light postulate and looked to see what he could derive using, again, some kind of synchrony conventions, a little bit obscure in his original papers, but again, spatial isotropy and then reciprocity. And I mentioned last time, reciprocity is regarded by some as a theorem, given the relativity principle and spatial isotropy. But now you end up, rather, instead of the Lorentz transformations, you get a one-parameter family of coordinate transformations that contain, amongst other things, the Galilean transformations. But the non-trivial result of this derivation, of course, is the existence of an invariant speed. Is there a lesson here for quantum mechanics? Well, I'm going to start by mentioning a paper that no doubt is very familiar to many of you, a paper in 2002 by Clifton, Boob, and Halvorsen, which starts by postulating three principles. No superluminal information transmission between two systems, so in other words, no signaling. No broadcasting of information contained in an unknown physical state, so a generalization of the no cloning theorem, the no cloning statement in quantum mechanics, and no unconditionally secure bit commitment. Now, what Clifton, Boob, and Halvorsen showed was on the basis of these principles, a theory that's formulated in the C star algebra approach to physics. And by the way, that is a big assumption that your physical theory can be put into the C star algebra formalism. It's constrained by these principles to give you basically a non-commuting algebra of observables, basically a tensor product type structure of the Hilbert space, so you have kinematic independence for separate systems, and the possibility of entanglement. Why do you do this? The fact, and I know I'm quoting from the authors, the fact that one can characterize quantum theory in terms of just a few simple information theoretic principles leads credence to the idea that an information theoretic point of view is the right perspective to adopt in relation to quantum theory. We are suggesting that the quantum theory be viewed not as first and foremost a mechanical theory of waves and particles, but as a theory about the possibilities and impossibilities of information transfer. Now, when you read this statement, I'm sure that for many people, a question arises immediately. Suppose you were to learn, contrary to fact or contrary to custom, suppose you were to learn statistical mechanics before you learn thermodynamics. phenomenological thermodynamics. So when you learn statistical mechanics, you learn about a mechanical underpinning of entropy. You learn about how to define entropy, for example, as being, let's roughly speaking, the size of a macro state in the phase space of a gas, say. That's well defined even if the system is not in equilibrium. In other words, if this is not an equilibrium macro state, nonetheless, the Boltzmann entropy is well defined. And a series of other things that give some way of understanding the thermal behavior of gases. Now you learn thermodynamics and you discover that an awful lot of that structure, an awful lot of your conclusions can be captured by way of certain very, very simple phenomenological claims, a very small collection of phenomenological claims, such as the impossibility of creating perpetual motion machines of certain kinds. Now, would you be tempted to say that the behavior, the thermal behavior of gases is ultimately about heat engines? Or would you be tempted to say that ultimately the most fundamental understanding of these things has to do with statistical inferences on the basis of a phase space associated with the mechanical degrees of freedom of a gas? Why would you be tempted to make the latter assumption rather than the former? Why would you be tempted to say thermodynamics is somehow more fundamental? That the behavior of a gas, for example, inside a heat engine is ultimately about heat engines themselves and certain kinds of impossibility claims. What's the most fundamental way of thinking about these things? Well, the reason that I mentioned this particular approach, and there are many others in the literature, I'll come back to this in a minute, is because Clifton, Boob, and Halvorsen make an explicit appeal to special relativity. And here's how it goes. The foundational significance of our derivation, as we see it, is that quantum mechanics should be interpreted as a principle theory, where the principles at issue are information theoretic. The distinction between principle and constructive theories is introduced by Einstein in his discussion of the significance of the transition from Newtonian to relativistic physics. Now, later on, I'm going to come back precisely to this distinction between principle and constructive theories. The question really is, take, for example, these three principles of CBH are actual theorems in quantum mechanics. Take the no-signaling theorem in quantum mechanics. I mean, that is a theorem of quantum mechanics. Why would you take a theorem in a theory and turn it into a postulate? Why would you reformulate the theory so what was originally a theorem now becomes a postulate? Haven't you lost thereby any possibility of explaining it, of deriving it? So how much work is special relativity able to do in order to motivate this kind of approach? So that's what I'll be looking at today. And of course, CBH is not the only such approach. We have here, for example, Philip Goyle here at Perimeter has done some very careful work on a similar kind of reconstruction of quantum mechanics based on quantum information theoretic notions. I don't know, Lucien, whether your axiomatization of quantum mechanics could be put with a similar sort of spirit. And of course, there are others. There are many others.
So in these efforts of axiomatization of quantum mechanics, one needs, what, four or five postulates? Is this paper along the same lines, but suggests that using information theory related postulates, one can really
You can go a long way to getting the kinematics of quantum mechanics. That's to say, the Hilbert space structure, and the structure of non-commuting observables, and a tensor product structure, so you can introduce generic entangled states, for example. They're not getting out, for example, the Schrodinger equation. They're not getting out the dynamics. And incidentally, it's worth bearing in mind, for example, that when you postulate no signaling. Actually, one has to be careful here, because a non-relativistic quantum mechanics, no signaling is not a theorem of the theory. It only holds for signaling by entangled states. It doesn't hold generally. You can signal in principle instantaneously in quantum mechanics, non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Of course, in the relativistic case, things are more complicated. But essentially, yes, they're trying to get at the kinematic, at least the kinematic structure the state space structure of quantum mechanics by introducing information theoretic particles.
Sorry, can you explain this part again in the sense, why is the non-superluminal information a needed postulate to recover non-relativistic quantum mechanics? You just said it, but can you re-explain it? What is the role of the first principle?
Well, it's a constraint on the possible state space of the system.
It gets you a tensor product, basically. Because, I mean, in their formulation, you imagine that subsystems can be assigned to any subalgebra of the C-star algebra that you have. And this is going to tell you that the C-star algebras have to commute, and basically you'll get a tensor product.
I can come back to this later if people want. But Einstein himself, if we look now at the history of special relativity, Einstein himself had what might be called misgivings about special relativity, and in particular about his formulation of 1905,
which is exactly what CBH are appealing to. What are the nature of these misgivings? Well, first of all, there's the limitations of the thermodynamic template, because Einstein, as we'll see, used thermodynamics systematically as a template in setting up special relativity in 1905. And he had misgivings. He realized that thermodynamics, although extremely well validated empirically, extremely solid as an empirical theory, is not fundamental. And we'll see how he expressed this in a moment. He referred at one stage to his theory as a half solvation to the predicament posed by the Michelson-Morley experiment. A half solvation. Why did he say half solvation? He also worried about the fact that in his 1905 paper, he treated rods and clocks as primitive bodies and not as structural composite bodies, not as complicated bodies. Why should a rod and a clock be considered a primitive entity? Now, the analog in quantum information theoretic approaches, reconstructions of quantum mechanics, is the word measurement. The word measurement appears, if I'm not mistaken, universally in quantum information theoretic approaches to reconstructing quantum mechanics. And the question is, why should the notion of measurement be considered a primitive? So that's sort of the analog of rods and clocks. Now, finally, Einstein was dismayed as he got older by the role that the light postulate played in his theory. I won't say an awful lot about this, but just to mention, as Einstein got older, and he was looking back on what he did in 1905, he stressed more and more not the light postulate and the relativity principle as being the fundamental restricting principles of special relativity, but Lorentz covariance. In other words, he appealed more and more to what was the outcome of the postulates as being fundamental, not the postulates themselves. Why? Because the point was, light is only one special theory, that's to say, electromagnetism or the quantum electrodynamics, whatever your theory of light is, it's just one theory amongst others. It's one theory of a fundamental interaction, non-gravitational interaction. The real essence of special relativity is that all the fundamental non-gravitational interactions are Lorentz covariant, not just light. Light doesn't have a special role in the theory. Now, to understand what Einstein was doing in 1905, let me just make some very quick remarks about the trailblazers. That's to say, the context that Einstein was working in. Now, those of you who came to the guest lecture that I gave in Lee Smolin's lectures on time, you'll forgive me because I'm going to repeat one or two of the comments that I made in that lecture. But I just wanted to set up the context of what Einstein was doing in 1905 to see in what sense he was original. Now, this is the great George Francis Fitzgerald. That's Henri Poincaré. That's Lorentz, of course, the greatest of the ether theorists. And that's Joseph Larmor, who worked in a very, very similar way, understanding to Lorentz's. But these are not the only figures that are, of course, of interest. This is Oliver Lodge, and I'll say a little bit more about why he's important in the story, extraordinary English autodidact. And finally, Michelson. And it's a remarkable thing that they were all born in the 1850s. Now, of course, Einstein's 1905 is often called the Annus Mirabilis, and I couldn't find a word for decade in Latin, so I put 1850s, the Anni Mirabili.
All of these figures were born in the 1850s. It was a wonderful decade for physics, but their deaths spanned over 40 years. So let's remind ourselves how it started. Fitzgerald was really, if there was a sort of a turning point in the history of physics when special relativity was born, of course, making a statement like that is highly contentious, but this is surely one of the candidates. Fitzgerald was trying to understand the Michelson-Morley experiment, as were anybody interested in ether theories. The Michelson-Morley experiment really was a shock. The second order null result of the ether wind experiment was a shock. The first order ether wind experiments were explained by appeal to the Fresnel drag coefficient. There really wasn't too much of a conceptual problem, but Michelson's experiment really was shocking. It didn't seem to be any natural explanation of a null result when you rotated the Michelson interferometer with respect to the direction, supposed direction of motion of the laboratory with respect to the ether wind. Why did you not see a shift in the interference fringes? Heaviside, in 1889, had solved the problem in Maxwell's theory. And the problem is the following. Take a charge with a spherical distribution of charge and calculate what the electrostatic field is surrounding that charge given Maxwell's equations. Well, intuitively, and in fact, theoretically, it turns out that the electrostatic field around a spherical distribution of charge is spherically symmetric. So the surfaces of equipotential are spheres. Now the question was, suppose you take that distribution of charge and you put it into motion with respect to the ether. What happens to it? Well, Heaviside showed, he found the solution not by brute force, but more or less by chance. And he showed that by solving Maxwell's equations, a solution of Maxwell's equations gives you a surface of equipotential that's now deformed. It was later called a Heaviside ellipsoid. So it's deformed in the direction of motion longitudinally. It becomes contracted. Now, Fitzgerald was reading Heaviside's work and suddenly thought to himself, what if the forces inside a solid body are like electrostatic forces, the forces between the molecules of the solid body? Won't they be affected by the motion with respect to the ether also? Won't therefore there be some kind of deformation in the shape of the stone block, the sandstone block, on which all these mirrors are attached rigidly in the Michelson-Morley experiment? So he postulated that the length of material bodies changes according to as they're moving through the ether or across it by an amount depending on the square of the ratio of their velocities to that of light. This is a deformation hypothesis, it's not a length contraction. Fitzgerald never used the word contraction because he realized that in order to solve the Michelson-Morley problem, it's sufficient that the deformation of the stone block is such that the ratio of the longitudinal change, it could even be an expansion, to the transverse change in length is gamma, the Lorentz factor. So this is a family of possible deformations, one of them being pure longitudinal length contraction, but nobody knew for sure why that would be singled out by nature. Now, Oliver Lodge, a friend of Fitzgerald, a great ether theorist in his own right, was very proud of saying that this idea of Fitzgerald's occurred when Fitzgerald was visiting Lodge in his study in Liverpool, and he said the suggestion bore the impress of truth from the start. That's how to solve the Michelson-Morley experiment puzzle. Happy are those, wrote Silberstein in a textbook a few years later, who are gifted with that immediate feeling for truth. So there's a picture of Oliver Lodge. Unfortunately, it wasn't so. Lodge clearly didn't believe that this was really a very plausible account. If you read Lodge's papers where he mentions this hypothesis, it's pretty clear from reading the papers that he didn't really believe it. He introduces it as a possibility. And Fitzgerald himself wrote a letter later on to Lorentz in which he mildly complained that Lodge had only published an account of his hypothesis as a result of reiterated positiveness or something like that on his part. In other words, he just forced Lodge into publishing this account. Now, several years later, a couple of years later, 3 years later, Lorentz had a very similar view, and he pointed out that you could solve the Michelson-Morley experiment by saying that the stone block could suffer a longitudinal change of length, a transverse change of length given by these factors, and that the ratio, well, not the ratio, but the difference between these factors is v squared over 2c squared, and this is exactly the same as the Fitzgerald hypothesis. But the ratio of these factors couldn't be established. Now, of course, these, as I mentioned in the case of Fitzgerald, these hypotheses were not just ad hoc. So, in particular, Fitzgerald stressed the fact that we know that electrical forces are affected by the motion of electrified bodies relative to the ether. This is just Heaviside's result. And it seems a not improbable supposition that the molecular forces are affected by motion and that the size of the body alters consequently. So this is not being pulled out of a hat. This is the result of thinking hard about Heaviside's result, which is a consequence of Maxwell's equations. Similarly, Lorentz said, Lorentz originally introduced the hypothesis as a mere hypothesis, but very quickly saw a dynamical underpinning to it. He says it's by no means far-fetched as soon as we assume that molecular forces are transmitted through the ether like electric and magnetic forces. The interpretation given by me and Fitzgerald was not artificial in a letter he wrote to Einstein in 1915. One arrives at the deformation hypothesis if one extends to other forces, that's to say intermolecular forces, what one could already say about the influence of a translation on electrostatic forces. Had I emphasized this more, the hypothesis would have created less of an impression of being invented ad hoc. What was the role of the ether in this? I mean, nowadays we often say, well, all very well and good. But these guys were ether theorists, they're old fashioned, they should never have been referring to the ether. What role did the ether play in these arguments? Virtually none. The argument was based on Maxwell's equations. Now, of course, for the ether theorists, there was, in principle, only one frame relative to which Maxwell's equations in the standard form are valid. That's the ether rest frame. But none of the argument depends on that. The argument simply presupposes there is an inertial frame relative to which Maxwell's equations are valid. And with respect to the equations in that frame, one can derive a shape deformation result, assuming that the molecular forces are like electrostatic forces. Nobody knew at the time. So really, the role of the ether was minimal. Now, I came across two sort of memorial plaques to Heaviside, the guy who did that original solution. And I thought it was very apt that the shape changed, because Heaviside exactly predicted that if you put it into motion, that's what will happen. But there were, that's so much for length contraction, but there were also premonitions of time dilation. This is well before Einstein. Joseph Larmor in 1897 was looking at Maxwell's equations and was applying what was a variant of what's now known in the literature as Lorentz's theorem of corresponding states, an attempt to explain why you don't see second order ether wind positive results when you test for the ether wind. And he predicted if you had a pair of charges of opposite sign that are orbiting each other periodically, putting aside the fact that this is not a stable system, of course, Larmor predicted on the basis of Maxwell's equations that, the period of that orbit would change if the pair of systems was put into uniform motion with respect to the original frame. Now that's clearly a premonition of time dilation, because that system is a little clock. And it's pretty clear that this was the inspiration for Bell's famous 1976 paper on how to teach special relativity. He says in a footnote somewhere, I was inspired by some remarks that he couldn't remember where he'd seen them, some remarks of Larmor, and it must have been this particular result. Several years later, very soon after that, literally just 2 years later, well, 1 year later, Leonard, the French physicist, had said, what if you did a Michelson-Morley experiment putting the whole thing into some kind of medium, a transparent medium with a non-trivial refractive index? Now if you rotate the Michelson interferometer, even if you allow for Fitzgerald-Lorentz contraction or deformation, what then? Well, it's easy to do a calculation to show you will get a shift in the interference fringes. So what would you expect Lorentz to have said? You might have thought Lorentz would say, hooray, finally we see sign of motion with respect to the ether. Let's test it. By this stage, there had been so many null results that everyone believed that there wasn't any experiment you could do. So Lorentz sat down and worked out what must be going on in order to prevent a positive result. And what he showed was that inside that source of light, there must be oscillating electrons that are producing electromagnetic radiation, and the period of oscillation must be affected by motion. So those oscillating electrons are also a clock that are going to dilate. That clock will dilate. And the combination of time dilation for that clock and Fitzgerald-Lorentz deformation will give you a null result. So Lorentz also had anticipated at least one aspect of time dilation. What neither said explicitly, and probably didn't even believe, was that time dilation was a universal phenomenon for clocks, independent of their constitution.
The same as we understand.
More or less. More or less. Actually, molecules, the word molecule is somewhat obscure to me in the ether theory, but I think it means, I mean, it's the force between the fundamental constituent, microscopic constituent parts of matter, essentially. Well, just very quickly to finish the trailblazers for special relativity, Henri Poincaré had already understood the conventionality of distance simultaneity and the relativity of simultaneity. In other words, he already had the Lorentz transformations. He didn't interpret them in the way that Einstein did operationally, but he realized that the relativity of simultaneity involved in those transformations is merely a consequence of how both observers, the stationary observer and the moving observer, synchronize their clocks. And that's exactly right. The relativity of simultaneity is merely a consequence of the fact that both observers synchronize their clocks in such a way as to make the one-way speed of light isotropic. That's all it is. And Einstein realized this later, but this is something that Poincaré had already understood. So a lot had been going on before Einstein. So let me just quickly say what Einstein was doing. Einstein's big problem was the Lie quantum. Suppose you want to show, as Einstein did, that classical Maxwell theory, Maxwell's electromagnetism, is the same in all inertial frames. In other words, satisfies the relativity principle. Suppose you want to prove that. Well, to prove it, you have to know what the coordinate transformations are between inertial frames, and you have to know if you can find transformations of the field variables, which together with the coordinate transformations leave the field equations covariant. Well, what are the coordinate transformations? What are they? Well, you could say, let's just choose the covariance group of Maxwell's equations. Actually, it's bigger than the Lorentz transformations, of course, because it also involves, I mean, it's really the conformal group, involves nonlinear coordinate transformations. But if we restrict ourselves to linear coordinate transformations, why not just choose that? Because Einstein had realized, and here he was unique in 1905, that Maxwell's equations were not strictly true. Because he'd just come across the light postulate. If light has a granular structure, as he argued in the previous paper, how can Maxwell's equations be strictly true? Incidentally, it's worth bearing in mind that the argument for the light quantum is essentially thermodynamical. I'll come back to this. It's essentially thermodynamical. Certain aspects of the physics of a black body radiation can be understood thermodynamically if you assume that light has a granular structure. And by the way, this argument does not appeal to Planck's law for the energy-frequency relationship. How then to get the coordinate transformations in order to show Maxwell's equations are covariant? Reflections of this type on the wave-particle nature of radiation, that's to say the fact that you have wave phenomena like diffraction and interference, which are explained by Maxwell's equations, but you also have this granular behavior. Remember, he was able to explain the photoelectric effect on the basis of the granular nature of light. Made it clear to me that as long ago, shortly after 1900, shortly after Planck's trailblazing work, that neither mechanics nor electrodynamics could, except in limiting cases, claim exact validity. By and by, I despaired of the possibility of discovering the true laws by means of constructive efforts based on known facts. The word constructive here is important, and I'll come back to that. So he adopted what might be called a policy of despair, using the template of thermodynamics. Now, thermodynamics had been very much in his mind, not just because he used it to derive the light postulate, because Einstein himself, by 1905, was one of the truly great authorities in the world on statistical mechanics. In fact, he is widely regarded nowadays as one of the fathers of statistical mechanics. And his PhD thesis, which he published as one of his papers in 1905, until about, I think, 1940, maybe 1950, was Einstein's most widely cited paper. The longer and more despairingly I tried, the more I came to the conviction that only the discovery of a universal formal principle could lead us to the assured results. Now, this is Einstein looking back late in life on what he was doing in 1905. So I have to put in that health warning. This is the late Einstein talking about the young Einstein. But it does make sense. Yeah, this is the autobiographical notes. The general principle, I beg your pardon, the example I saw before me was thermodynamics. The general principle was there given in the statement, the laws of nature are such that it is impossible to construct a perpetual mobile of the first and second kind. How then could such a universal principle be found which would lead us to a derivation of the coordinate transformations between inertial frames? Well, what did Einstein do? He abandoned a constructive approach. He abandoned the kind of approach that Lorentz, Fitzgerald, and others were using, because they were essentially comparing intermolecular forces with electrostatic forces. Einstein realized that electromagnetism, that Maxwell's equations weren't exact, weren't fundamental. So he used this template of thermodynamics. Let's find phenomenological principles, not principles about the structure of matter. Phenomenological principles that look like thermodynamical principles. And of course, he chose the relativity principle and the light postulate. Of course, he did much more than that. His operational analysis of the coordinate systems was original and unique. Nobody understood the coordinate transformations in the way that Einstein did in 1905. Nobody read off from the coordinate transformations kinematic effects like time dilation and length contraction in the way that Einstein did. But in doing so, he rediscovered Poincaré's conventionality of distance simultaneity and the relativity of simultaneity. Of course, he also rejected the ether as redundant, but merely as redundant. He doesn't say it doesn't exist. He simply says, I have no need for this hypothesis. Anyone who believes in the relativity principle as being exact is not going to appeal to the ether unless you think that an electromagnetic field requires a substratum to live in. And that's what Lorentz did. Lorentz didn't imagine that space was substantial enough, space-time was not substantial enough to act as a substratum for fields. What are fields? Fields are properties of something. What is that something? Well, for Lorentz, it had to be some kind of entity. The electromagnetic waves are a propagating disturbance in something. Now, of course, just because the relativity principle holds doesn't necessarily mean that's false. But Einstein said, hey, let's just live with the fact that fields are things in themselves. And they don't require a substrate. So now let me go on to Einstein's misgivings. In 1907, 2 years after the famous relativity paper, Einstein writes to his friend Paul Ehrenfest, the principle of relativity, or more exactly, the principle of relativity together with the principle of the constancy of the speed of light, is not to be conceived as a complete system. In fact, it is not a system at all, but merely to be conceived as a heuristic principle, which, when considered by itself, contains only statements about rigid bodies, clocks, and light signals. We are dealing here only with a principle that's similar to the second law of the theory of heat, permits the reduction of certain laws to others. Maybe that's not entirely clear, but you can see here he's stressing the connection between the relativity theory and thermodynamics. Now, here is in a letter to Sommerfeld in 1908, is a bit more explicit. Sommerfeld said to him, if I look at the relativity theory, I don't see a model of the electron. What's the structure of the electron in the relativity theory? You say that the mass of the electron, for example, changes with speed. You say that if the electron has a finite volume, that volume is going to contract with respect in motion. But where's the model of the electron? And Einstein says, so first to the question of whether I consider the relativistic treatment of, for example, the mechanics of electrons as definitive, no, certainly not. It's not the object of the theory to provide a theory of the electron. It seems to me, too, that a physical theory can be satisfactory only when it builds up its structures from elementary foundations. Now, it's clear from the context that elementary foundations means constructive hypotheses about microscopic structure. So any theory that's really satisfactory has to give a picture of the electron. Any theory of the microscopic nature of reality has to give you a model of the electron, amongst other things. That's not what special relativity is doing. The theory of relativity is not more conclusively and absolutely satisfactory than, for example, classical thermodynamics was before Boltzmann had interpreted entropy as probability. Boltzmann did something very, very profound to the thermodynamical notion of entropy. He not only he redefined it in absolutely new terms and showed that it applied to systems or arrangements of things where the classical notion of entropy doesn't even apply, such as non-equilibrium states. If the Michelson-Morley experiment had not put us in the worst predicament, no one would have perceived the relativity theory as a half salvation. But he says, well, besides, I believe that we are still far from having satisfactory elementary foundations for electrical and mechanical processes. Well, this is the excuse. Of course, the theory is not fundamental. It's not giving you a model of the electron. But we don't have one. In 1908, there was Einstein's light quantum. There were Maxwell's equations. And nobody knew how to reconcile these two ideas that both had, obviously, a certain amount of truth. Of course, nobody in 1908, almost nobody, believed in the light quantum. And of course, Niels Bohr, for example, one of the fathers of quantum mechanics, didn't accept the validity of the light quantum until 1923. So the light quantum was probably the elementary particle, the photon, that took longest to be accepted by the physics community. But I just want to say that in both cases, Einstein is emphasizing the limitations of special relativity, not its strengths. Well, it has the same strengths and weaknesses as thermodynamics. The postulates are very, very well founded empirically. All the attempts to measure the ether wind fail, therefore the relativity principle should apply to electrodynamics. But on the other hand, it's not giving you a fundamental picture of the microscopic nature of matter. That's not its job. Now, again, Clifton, Boob, and Halvorsen mentioned the distinction between principle theories and constructive theories, so I'll just say quickly what that is. In 1919, Einstein was asked to write a letter, to write a small article in the Times, the London Times, about relativity theory. Remember, this was a year after Eddington's famous experiment. Actually, maybe being the same year as Eddington's famous experiment on the deflection of light, starlight, around the surface of the sun. This had propelled Einstein into world stardom. He became an international figure overnight. And he was asked by the Times to write an account of relativity theory for a lay reader. And he made this famous distinction between principal constructive theories. This was in the air all the way from the end of the last century. The great physicists and mathematical physicists were constantly making distinctions between certain kinds of hypotheses in their theories. Some are more fundamental than others. Some are more overarching. For example, conservation of energy. No one would buy a theory in which energy was not conserved. So it's like a principle you don't want to give up no matter what. But that doesn't fix the details of the theory. So this distinction between fundamental principles, principles and a constructive theory was in the air. Many people were commenting on it. So what Einstein is doing is really just spelling something out that was around.
I had never heard this term, principle versus constructive, until Jeff Booth started talking about it about 4 years ago. So it was in the air, but was it well defined? Did people actually make a distinction? Is it really a famous distinction?
Well,
or is it just something that arose when Jeff Booth decided to point out?
Oh, no. I mean, no, the principle constructive distinction, I mean, Einstein, all the historical scholars on relativity theory were aware that Einstein was making this distinction to explain the thermodynamic nature of his theory. So this is very well known in the historical literature. But as I say, what Einstein was doing was taking something that was in the air. I mean, if you look at Lorentz's work, Poincaré's work, where they start talking about the nature of theories more generally, they make similar distinctions. What Einstein was doing was defining a principle theory as one that looks more like thermodynamics. In other words, it has phenomenological principles. So a principle theory for Einstein, like thermodynamics, is based on phenomenological regularities, which are oblivious to the nature of the microscopic makeup of bodies. Now remember the strength of thermodynamics and the weakness. When you want to understand why a heat engine has a limited amount of efficiency, what is the rule that determines the efficiency of the heat engine, the maximum efficiency of the heat engine? You will discover in thermodynamics that it depends on the ratio of the temperatures of the two reservoirs in the heat engine in the Carnot cycle. Now, it is a beautiful derivation that Carnot gave, which is independent of the nature of the working parts of the heat engine. That's its strength. It's independent of the nature of the working parts of the heat engine. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about a steam engine or anything else. However you create some kind of interaction between heat and work, you're going to get a certain limitation on the efficiency of the engine. It's also its weakness, in a sense, because it's not telling you exactly what's going on. That's a principle theory of the kind Einstein is talking about. A constructive theory, on the other hand, is like the kinetic theory of gases or statistical mechanics, which is based on dynamical hypotheses governing the microscopic, that's to say, hidden, hypothetical structure of bodies. That's a constructive theory. Now, is this a really tight distinction? No. Very few distinctions in either physics or philosophy are really that tight. It's just very useful. All of us have an instinctive understanding as to, in the sense that thermodynamics is a rather different kind of theory from, say, the kinetic theory of gases. It's that distinction that Einstein is stressing. Now, we saw that in 1908, Einstein says, it seems to me that a physical theory can be satisfactory only when it builds up its structures from elementary foundations. Now, but it's clear from the context he means a constructive theory. And in 1919, in the same article in the Times, he says, when we say we have succeeded in understanding a group of natural processes, we invariably mean that a constructive theory has been found which covers the processes in question. Constructive theory. Now, that isn't to say that a principle theory isn't useful. The principle theory is extremely useful when you don't have a constructive theory. That's exactly why he did what he did in 1905. But it was a kind of policy of despair. And until the end of his life, if you look in the autobiographical notes, for example, it's very curious. He uses the same excuse for the principle theory approach to relativity that he used in 1919, and that he used in 1921, as we'll see. And what was that excuse? We don't have a theory of matter. So we don't really have a constructive theory. Well, the obvious question arises, well, what about quantum mechanics? By 1949, when he was writing his autobiographical notes, didn't quantum mechanics already provide a very deep underpinning to the nature of matter? Didn't we have some kind of relatively sophisticated understanding of the stability of matter by using quantum mechanics? Of course, Einstein had a very complicated relationship with quantum mechanics. Now, just to finish on Einstein, previously is stressing, look, We have principle theories and we have constructive theories. A principle theory is useful when in the absence of a constructive theory, essentially. But the constructive theory provides the fundamental understanding, insofar as there is any, of the processes in question. But there was another aspect of his original paper, which he referred to as sinful. In 1921, he wrote, and this is in relation to the business of rods and clocks, "It is clear that the solid body, that's to say the rigid body, the ruler, and the clock do not, in the conceptual edifice of physics, play the part of irreducible elements, but that of composite structures, which must not play any independent part in theoretical physics. You don't put them in by hand at the very heart of your basic theories of the world. But it is my conviction that in the present state of development of theoretical physics, these concepts must still be employed, et cetera, because we still don't have a theory of matter." So he's justifying his use of the primitive notion of existence of rods and clocks by simply saying, well, I'd like to be able to tell you what they are, but we don't know yet. This is in 1921. In his autobiographical notes, he says, in a similar vein, "One is struck by the fact that in the special theory of relativity, it introduces two kinds of physical things. First of all, measuring rods and clocks, which you remember that for Einstein, if you don't have them, you can't define what you mean by an inertial coordinate system. You can't define what you mean by intervals of coordinate intervals in these very special inertial coordinate systems. What do the spatial intervals mean? What do the temporal intervals mean? For Einstein, and this is very questionable, but for Einstein, what they mean is precisely what is determined by ideal rigid rods and ideal clocks. But then there are other things in the theory, for example, like the electromagnetic field. You remember the second part of Einstein's 1905 paper is all about the Lorentz covariance of Maxwell's equations. This, in a certain sense, is inconsistent. As the basic equations, objects, I beg your pardon, strictly speaking, measuring rods and clocks would have to be resented as solutions of the basic equations. They're objects consisting of moving atomic configurations. That's what they are. They're not primitive entities. They're composite entities that are chosen for certain kinds of properties that they possess. Not, as it were, as theoretically self-sufficient entities. Now he goes on to say, of course, that this is a sin. But he uses the same excuse. This is 1949. We still don't really have a satisfactory theory of the structure of matter. So I'm going to allow myself to still talk about rods and clocks as being primitive. But notice he's saying that this is really only a stopgap. Now I'm going to at least put out as a possibility that the same should be said about measurement in the fundamental approach to quantum mechanics. Measurement is not a fundamental notion. A measurement is an interaction of a very special kind between fundamental quantum mechanical systems. It cannot be considered a primitive because, after all, if you don't have a theory that tells you what those interactions are, you can't specify what a measurement is. You can't say of a given interaction whether it's a measurement. And even if you do say it's a measurement, you can't say what it's measuring. Well, by the way, this is by far, I mean, the message that I'm pushing here is by far, I mean, it's not unique. I mean, not unique to me, certainly. There are plenty of historical precedents. I'd like to mention, for example, Pauli's wonderful review paper that he wrote at the age of 21 that so amazed Einstein. He wrote an incredible review paper, an encyclopedic review paper on both special and general relativity. This is while he was still writing a PhD on the quantum mechanical behavior of molecules or something. He's looking at Einstein's derivation of the Lorentz transformations, and he notes, my God, this is amazing. Einstein has told us what rods and clocks are doing in motion, they're contracting and dilating respectively, without saying anything about their atomic makeup. That's remarkable. But then he stands back and says, should one then completely abandon any attempt to explain the Lorentz contraction atomistically? We think that the answer to this question should be no. The contraction of a measuring rod is not an elementary, but a very complicated process. And in particular, it would not take place except for the covariance with respect to the Lorentz group of the basic equations of the electron theory. The electron theory at the time was the best they had in terms of the theory of matter. He's referring to the Lorentz electron theory. As well as those laws, as yet unknown to us, which determine the cohesion of the electron itself. You will remember that in Lorentz's theory of the electron itself is a little sphere that has charge smeared on its surface. Well, why doesn't it blow up? Why doesn't that distribution of charge repel, each bit repel another, every other bit on the surface and just blow up? Well, there must be some kind of force of cohesion. This is sometimes referred to as the Poincaré force. What is it? It can't be electrodynamic. It's got to be something else. So just to understand the very cohesiveness of the electron, one has to apply to unknown interactions or forces that are non-electromagnetic. But what Pauli is saying is it had better be that they're Lorentz covariant. It had better be that all the fundamental forces in matter are Lorentz covariant. Otherwise, that rod is not going to do what you expect it to do. That's the fundamental issue. And similarly, Eddington, in a slightly less clear way, stated in 1928, there is really nothing mysterious about the Fitzgerald contraction. It would be an unnatural property of a rod pictured in the old way as a continuous substance occupying space in virtue of its substantiality. Well, there's a nice little piece of metaphysics for you. But it is entirely natural. It is an entirely natural property of a swarm of particles held in delicate balance by electromagnetic forces, which are Lorentz covariant, occupying space by buffeting away anything that tries to enter. Eddington's remark is not quite as sophisticated as Pauli's because you get the impression that everything is just electromagnetic, and of course it can't be. But it's the same fundamental idea. A rod contracts because of how it's made. And the only way to understand that is by not considering a rod to be a primitive entity, but considering it to be a composite structured body. So there are a number of people who've made making similar points over the decades, and I might mention Hermann Weyl in 1918. We've seen Pauli, Eddington, Swan in 1941, a relatively little known contributor to the literature, but he made these points very, very clearly. Janossi in 1971, John Bell of the famous Bell Inequality, who wrote in a similar vein on a number of occasions, Dennis Deeks from the University of Utrecht, and others since then. And let me just finish with a remark from John Bell, because it has a rather remarkable property. John Bell wrote a very nice article to celebrate, what would it have been? Well, it was an article about Fitzgerald. I don't know whether it was a centenary of some kind, but it was an article about Fitzgerald. It may have been, when did John Bell die? Do you remember? Fitzgerald himself died in 1893, okay, so it wasn't the centenary of the death. Yeah. Anyway, he wrote a very nice paper on what Fitzgerald's contributions to physics. Of course, Bell had a soft spot for the Irish and the Irish physicists. And he said the following. He was writing about the Fitzgerald contraction and Fitzgerald's original idea of how to understand shape deformation dynamically. If you are, for example, quite convinced of the second law of thermodynamics, of the increase of entropy, there are many things you can get directly from the second law which are very difficult to get directly from a detailed study of the kinetic theory of gases. I mentioned before that if you choose the laws of thermodynamics, you can easily derive, on the basis of a very elegant argument due to Carnot, the limitations on the, in principle, limitations on the efficiency of a heat engine. Try to get that out using the kinetic theory of gases. It'll be a mess. But you have no excuse for not looking at the kinetic theory of gases to see how the increase of entropy actually comes about. Why? Because it's a more fundamental theory. In the same way, although Einstein's theory of special relativity would lead you to expect a Fitzgerald contraction, you are not excused from seeing how the detailed dynamics of the system also leads to the Fitzgerald contraction. And what's remarkable about this is that I don't think John Bell was even aware that Einstein put so much emphasis on the thermodynamic template in arriving at his theory of special relativity, this connection between thermodynamics and the kinetic theory of gases. So let me finish by saying the following, and this is a somewhat perhaps provocative conclusion. Special relativity, like thermodynamics, is not a fundamental theory. It's a very special theory in physics. It's not about stuff per se. It's a restricting principle. And of course, what that restricting principle is Lorentz covariance on the fundamental theories of the non-gravitational interactions. It's unique in physics. Well, it's rather like thermodynamics. Thermodynamics and the special theory of relativity have a very similar status. They're not fundamental theories, but they're restricting principles on fundamental theories. Now, if you have a fundamental theory that explains, take, for example, the kinetic theory of gases, it would be a little bit shocking if you couldn't, in principle, explain from the kinetic theory of gases why you cannot create a perpetual motion machine of the second kind, or from statistical mechanics generally. It would be a little bit shocking. Now, I don't want to be too disingenuous here. It is a fact that there is no consensus on how to do it. But everyone thinks you can. And certainly everybody thinks you should be able to. You should be able to take the fundamental postulates of the statistical mechanics and derive, as a theorem, the impossibility of creating a perpetual motion machine of the second kind. Why then would you turn that into a postulate? The minute you've turned it into a postulate, you've lost any ability to explain it. The excuse that Einstein had in 1905 for taking the relativity principle and the light postulate as postulates, and later by just introducing, in a simpler way, Lorentz covariance, was that there wasn't a constructive theory in the background available. But in the case of the kinetic theory of gases, we do have one. Now let's come back to Clifton, Boob, and Halvorsen and the quantum information theoretical approach. We've got a theory, and it's called quantum mechanics. The no signaling theorem is a theorem. The no cloning theorem is a theorem. No bit commitment is, as far as I understand it, also a theorem. Why would you turn those into postulates? Now, a remark that's often been made in discussions with people defending this point of view is the following. Well, where do all those complicated postulates about Hilbert spaces, complex Hilbert spaces come from? Observables being associated with self-adjoint operators, if that's the language that you like. Where does the Schrodinger equation come from on all of these things? Well, let me ask the following question. When you pick up a textbook on general relativity, the first chapter you read frequently a very, very large technical account of what a differential manifold is. Who ordered that? Why are we so much unhappier accepting the basic postulates related to the Hilbert space structure of quantum mechanics? Why are we unhappy in that case, but not so unhappy in discussing, for example, the formal structure of general relativity? And another thing, why would we take a theory which in principle can be defined without using the word measurement in its postulates? And let me remind you that there are a number of interpretations of quantum mechanics in which the word measurement does not appear in the postulates. Why would you take that theory and reformulate it in such a way that measurement becomes fundamental, a primitive notion, when that doesn't happen in any other theory in physics? Unless I'm mistaken. If somebody can think of another theory in physics in which the word measurement appears, I mean fundamental theory, in which the word measurement appears in the fundamental postulates, I'd be interested to know what it is. I think I've said enough.
But you just answered your last question in the following sense. Einstein emphasized that rods and clocks were fundamental in his formulation. Stopgap, though they may be for him or for what he wanted of physics. But there they were, rods and clocks were at the foundation.
didn't call it a measurement, but you did.
But he said it was a sin.
He did, but they're still at the foundation. Now, maybe in other developments they're not, but at least for him, they were still at the foundation.
Well, but look, suppose you, I mean, Einstein himself, as he grew older, as I mentioned before, when he talked about special relativity, he conveniently forgot the 1905 formulation of special relativity. And this is very clear in the autobiographical notes. It's a very funny thing. He conveniently forgot his own postulates. You remember there was a quote from the autobiographical notes that, where Einstein says, "Where can we find the restricting principle that plays the role of a thermodynamic principle postulate? Where can we find this when we're trying to derive the Lorentz transformation?" Well, he then goes on to say that restricting principle is Lorentz covariance. That's not what he was saying in 1905. If he put in Lorentz covariance from the outset, his derivation of the Lorentz transformations would have been circular. So the fundamental postulate in special relativity, properly understood, is Lorentz covariance. And that nothing is being said about rods and clocks. However, if all the fundamental interactions are Lorentz covariance, and you have a theory of matter which allows for stable matter, and of course this means quantum mechanics, if the fundamental equations of matter in quantum mechanics are Lorentz covariant, you can show, and this is exactly what Bell did in his example, you can show that a rod built out of these structures is going to contract because of the Lorentz covariance. But the notion of a rigid body and the notion of a clock is not fundamental. What's fundamental is a structural property, the symmetry group of those fundamental laws. So I would say rods and clocks are not fundamental to the correct understanding of special relativity, but it's still a restrictive theory. It's still not a fundamental theory. Andreas?
Would you say we have something like constructive theory of relativity today?
It's not in the nature of the theory to be constructive theory. Mm-hmm. It is like thermodynamics. Yeah. It's just in the nature of the theory. I remember Chris Isham once making a remark to this effect. Yeah. At the time, I'm not sure I fully understood it. Yeah. He said special relativity is not a theory. Now, what he meant by that, I think, is that it's not a fundamental theory. It's simply a restriction, a proposed restriction on fundamental theories. Mm-hmm. Lucian, did you want to?
So one way to think about this is it depends what you're trying to do. If you're merely trying to understand an existing theory and leave it at that, then I think one should be aiming just for a fundamental interpretation. But if you're trying to make progress and sort of go beyond current physics to new physics, then I think one might want to do something more. So if you look at the situation in 1905, Einstein was aware that physics was changing. But at the same time, he was trying to understand the equations of electromagnetism, and so he took this operational approach, and it was very useful. It's difficult to imagine going from the physics before Einstein to the physics after Einstein without that operational interlude. And so in answer to the question whether one should just take the present realist interpretations of quantum theory, like Bohm and many worlds and collapse, I would say certainly not, because that would be akin to pursuing the sort of various ether-based approaches to understanding electromagnetism at the time. What we need, I think, is an operational interlude to get us past the various sort of ontological presuppositions we're making to a new sort of way of thinking, just in the same way that we were able to get from ether-based way of thinking about reality to something more subtle and refined. And the maybe way of doing that without going through an operational interlude, because I don't see what it is.
Good. Okay. I mean, I want to make two remarks here. First of all, if the object of the exercise is to create a theory by using these, let's say, either phenomenological stroke quantum information theoretic postulates, is to create a theory that will deviate from quantum mechanics. That's to say, holds open the possibility of new predictions that are inconsistent with quantum mechanics. That's one thing.
And I can understand that. I'm not sure that that's what Clifton, Boob, and Halvorsen are doing. I'm not sure it's what Philip is doing.
For that reason, we shouldn't have said the information theoretic approach. There's a whole cluster of approaches.
Sure.
And at least of myself, I can say I align myself more along lines of the kind of thought that Lucien was expressing. For instance, I would say, at this stage, at least in my life, I would call quantum mechanics something more akin to a principle theory. But that's not a call to stop right there. Instead, it's a call, just like from the one of Einstein that you presented, to say, okay, this is our starting point, actually, for launching into something like a construct.
Okay.
Find a way to do it. Now, Clifton, Boob, and Halvorsen, at least in some of Boob's papers, has been the let's stop at this point idea.
Well, can I just, I'll come back to your point, Chris, but I just wanted to make another remark in relation to what Lucien said. I think it's very important to disentangle two things in Einstein's thinking. Very, very important. And they're often conflated. First, there's the distinction in Einstein's mind between the principal constructive theories and the decision to use thermodynamics as a template in 1905. That's one thing. A completely separate thing is an operational analysis of the coordinate systems and their transformations. That's got nothing to do with the first. That operational interpretation of the coordinate intervals and the coordinate transformations, is something that once Einstein made it, everybody adopted. Lorentz adopted it. This is one of the things that really impressed Lorentz. Einstein has systematized our understanding of the Lorentz transformations. But that doesn't cut any ice in relation to the principal constructive theory distinction. Everyone accepted it. But Lorentz continued to believe in an ether. He continued to believe in the importance of having a theory of the electron and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to make that distinction.
Yeah.
The operationalism for me is really not the issue here, insofar as Einstein was an operationalist at all, which I sometimes doubt. But coming back to Chris's point, to say that quantum mechanics as we presently have it is a principle theory goes very much against at least Einstein's own definition of a principle theory. Why? Because a principle theory for Einstein is like thermodynamics in the sense that it's based on phenomenological principles. Since when did you bump into a Hilbert space? That's not a phenomenological notion. If I say the state space for a quantum mechanical system on a set of rays or something in a complex, multidimensional Hilbert space. That's not a phenomenological state. Nor, by the way, really, is the statement that all the laws are Lorentz covariant. By going to that version of special relativity, Einstein had already moved away somewhat from his definition of a principle theory. It becomes a little bit more like a constructive theory, but it's still a restricting principle. But I can't see how one would use the term. I mean, the whole point about quantum mechanics that I understand that motivates so much work in the quantum information theoretic approach, the reformulations and reconstructions, is precisely because. Okay.
Watch out.
Some. Is precisely the fact that there's this claim that, look, here's this beautiful economy in special relativity. You have two or three axioms, postulates. So economical. Whereas, in quantum mechanics, you have to read a page or something of postulates involving complex mathematical constructs, structures. Well, which, by the way, goes for most theories, doesn't it? I mean, again, look at the example of general relativity. Is that economical in the sense of special relativity? No. But the point about these theories that involve a whole lot of rather complicated postulates and posits about mathematical structures and state spaces and dynamical equations of motion and so on, is that they're precisely not principle theories, they're constructive theories. They're ultimately theories about hypothetical microscopic entities, things like the space-time manifold, or a set of events or something. So I would balk at referring to quantum mechanics as principle theory. But I do take your point. That the quantum information theoretic, let's say,
program has many, many variants, and people are doing different things and are motivated perhaps by different considerations. So I do take your point that I'm being a little bit too simplistic.
Can I just make a remark about ontology? So it's not clear that searching for ontology won't lead to progress, because you've seen this a number of times in physics. You can take Faraday with his field lines. He started thinking of the field as, you know, an entity in itself, and that led to Maxwell's equations. You can take statistical physics when you start thinking about gases as ontologically as point particles, that leads to progress. You can take the quark model, you can take general relativity, where Einstein, through the equivalence principle, start thinking of the gravitational field as curved geometries. So, I mean, operational approach is successful sometimes, and ontological approaches is successful in other cases. I don't think there's a preference. One should just go where you can make progress. But then, of course, people have different intuitions where progress comes about.
Sean, you had a question? Well, I think we'd better leave it at that if we're going to get lunch. Thank you.